Afghanistan faces an economic meltdown. The UN warns that nearly every Afghan will be in poverty by next year, but aid has dried up. And the Taliban's been blocked from accessing the country's foreign assets. So what will the international community do now? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Much of the world is facing a stark choice with Afghanistan. Accept the country's new Taliban leaders or continue shutting them out. The group's been barred from accessing the Afghan central bank's foreign assets worth $10 billion. And humanitarian aid has stopped flowing in. Now, the UN's warning of an economic meltdown. 97% of the population could be living in poverty within a year. Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling for an urgent injection of cash into Afghanistan. That means talking and dealing with the Taliban.
The UN has a key role to play in humanitarian aid to a people that is now in a desperate situation. Desperate situation. And so we decided that it was our duty to engage the Taliban to create the conditions for the possibility of effective humanitarian aid, impartial, to reach all areas and to take into account our concerns in relation to women and girls, for instance.
Already, the UN's refugee agency says it will engage with the group to ensure displaced Afghans receive help. Many have crossed into neighbouring Pakistan, which has been urging the US to unfreeze Afghanistan's assets. Its foreign minister says international governments can't keep isolating the Taliban.
But at the same time, there is recognition of a new reality. At the same time, there is awareness that engagement is required. A dialogue for a better understanding can be useful. So I see an interest, a desire to engage, but not a rush to recognise.
Let's introduce our panel in Kabul. Badullah Bahir, Lecturer of Transitional Justice at the American University of Afghanistan. In Pittsburgh, Jennifer Brick Murtazashvili, an Associate Professor at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. And in Dublin, Michael Semple, Professor at the Mitchell Institute for Global Peace and Security and Justice at Queen's University, Belfast. A warm welcome to you all. Let's begin in Kabul first. Now, we often talk about the international community. Now, it might be international, but it's not much of a community. It's a mishmash of competing interests and of nation states' own interests. Now, Ubaydullah, at some point, you're going to have to deal with the Taliban. That's going to be the reality. But until that happens, there's only really a couple of countries that are dealing with the Taliban. That seems to be China and Pakistan. Is that the reality, do you think?
I think with the recent times, we've seen many other players emerge as well, especially central to them is Qatar. If you see Qatar with regards to the airport functioning, as well as even within Kabul, they have their offices set up in Sirena. They have been quite central to the communication between the international community and the Taliban, and that's good. There can be more mediators as well. We do understand the international community is in a difficult situation where for it to recognize the Taliban or engage with it too much means whitewashing or ignoring a lot of the violations of human rights and international law that are being committed. The Taliban excused themselves by saying that these are the early stages of their state and things would get better. But in such time or time that we don't have with the looming economic crisis and recession coming in, these mediators can play a positive role in helping the Taliban set up a model for their economy, as well as help the international community have some sort of indirect engagement, because the first line of fire is going to be the common Afghan people. If the economic recession happens, if any sanctions are imposed, they are the people that would suffer the most.
In Pittsburgh, Jennifer, this is a situation where aid agencies have actually been dealing with the Taliban on the ground now for a number of years in the areas that they controlled before they took over the whole country. There is some institutional experience in when it comes to dealing with the Taliban. Has that been a successful, positive experience?
Well, it depends on who you ask. I think for the political outcomes, it probably contributed to the collapse of the state because it gave the Taliban a kind of legitimacy in the areas that it controlled. The Taliban was very able to effectively channel that aid to show that they could provide some kind of governance. And they were eschewed some of the national level programs that were somewhat unpopular with the Afghan people and able to promote the kinds of basic service delivery that people demanded. And they were able to also blend that with their form of dispute resolution, which at the time was much more effective and efficient than what was offered by the state. Now that they are the government, this, I think, is a big question for all of us to look at, is whether they can translate some of the things that they did at the grassroots level and their ability to channel aid and donors into national level success. So on the one hand, it was very effective for the Taliban to be able to use and utilize international NGOs who were working in Afghanistan. You know, let's remember that prior to the fall of the government this past month, the government only controlled 30% of the country's territory uncontested, right? So this means that the Taliban and NGOs and aid agencies have been working side by side, for better or worse, for a very long time.
I want to bring in Michael here, Michael in Dublin. We keep hearing, we haven't seen much evidence of it so far, but we do keep hearing that this is a very different Taliban to the government in 1996, that they've learnt lessons, that they are willing to engage. Do you hold any truck with that argument?
Absolutely not. I think that the Taliban have done a very good job on building up their media operation. They over the past almost a decade now, they operated a political mission in Doha, which they used to put across a sort of a rosy version of their reality, but it never really reflected what was going on the ground. And I think that's the case now. And I think that the Taliban leadership are going to find this a real challenge, because it was okay to have this gap while they were in the insurgency and they weren't responsible for the fate of the Afghan people. But now that they're in charge, if they don't find some way of becoming a bit more compromising, they will pay the price, but first of all, their people will pay the price. And I'll give you a classic example of this. In the public front, the Taliban leadership are talking about how they have a general amnesty for people who served with the previous government. They're saying that when the United Nations engaged with them, they told the United Nations that they wanted Afghan civil servants who had left the country in the evacuation to return. But then, as the authorities would get their feet under the desk, one of the first things they do is freeze the bank accounts of all civil servants. Their new Minister of Defence passes out an instruction saying that no single member of the former armed forces should be allowed to join the Taliban's new forces. The informal comment amongst the Taliban as being that, maybe we can have some of the old officers with us briefly to teach us some things, and then we will kick them out the door. And we've had house searches conducted against people who worked with the previous government, trying to seize property which they supposedly had with them, generally intimidate them. So the completely contradictory messaging going out. And obviously, there will be consequences from trying to freeze out something like a million people who worked with the previous government in either civilian or military departments.
In Kabul, Ubaydullah, do you agree with that assessment?
There is an interesting quotation that kept running through my mind. It says, do you know what the definition of madness is? It is to try the same thing and expect different results. And in this case, I mean, it's the old guard running the cabinet. How do you expect things to be different? The problem isn't just one of an attitude problem or a behavioral issue. The issue at the core of it is incompetence, is the lack of basic governance skills, basic administration skills. And here's the problem. The problem is that the Taliban, unlike other political parties in a lot of different countries in the world, and even in Afghanistan, didn't really function ever in an office-like setup, in a very formal setup for a political party, where within your party, you have your own offices, you have your own documentation. It has always been an insurgency. Even back in the 1995-96, they never formally sat in and accepted what the mood for governance was going to be in the world and tried to adapt to it. All of those are problematic things. So it's not just about what the Taliban decide to do. It's about whether they have the capacity to implement it. Again, if you're going to go with the lustration process, lock out people who worked for the previous regime or the armed forces, you are leaving 100,000 trained people with weapons in their houses who are dissatisfied with the system. Tell me if that doesn't mean at some point you will have an armed resistance standing up to you. If you're going to lock out everyone who's worked for the previous government, let's call it a de-republication, something like the denazification or the de-Ba'athification in Iraq, those are some of the major reasons why the general populace ends up being dissatisfied and leads to an eventual outburst from their part. So the Taliban really need to realize what they're up against. And this isn't the hills and the battlefronts anymore. This is real life. The lives of 40 million people depend on the Taliban to get their act together. Else we will face an
economic crisis. I'm just going to get a reaction there from Jennifer in Pittsburgh. Jennifer, a little bit earlier, you said one of the reasons that the Taliban were able to keep control in the areas is that the aid agencies gave them the money and therefore they were able to have a sheen of legitimacy that allowed them to govern. We're about to make that money 10, 15 times larger and give it to a government. Does that insulate them from the criticisms that we've been hearing from Dublin and Kabul?
Well, not necessarily, because it's not just about the money and the resources, it's also about the delivery. And I think this is where Ubaidullah's point is spot on. The Taliban has to administer and deliver this. And who's going to be doing that if all of these other organizations are frozen out, if the government, so many government officials are frozen out, who's going to be doing this work? If the international community isn't engaging in the way that it once was, then who's going to be administering and delivering this on for the Taliban? And I think this is a very important question that we should be asking. But I also do think, you know, while I'm very negative about these kinds of outcomes, I think that this is really an opportunity for both the Taliban and the international community to really put their heads together if there's a real interest in this and making the government much more effective and efficient. And, you know, one thing where I'll depart with others is that I don't think we need people necessarily sitting in government offices and, you know, with suits and ties and to be able to do this very well. Some governance issues are so simple that over the past 20 years, they became so complicated, so bureaucratized. The Afghan government itself was really quite messy, didn't do a lot of the direct implementation itself. And where it did do direct implementation, it was caught up in webs of corruption. So there's a real opportunity to fix a lot of the issues and the maladies that Afghanistan has suffered from that drove the insurgency over the past 20 years. But I would absolutely agree with Ubaidullah and Michael here that the Taliban don't seem to be learning the lessons of governments, not just of the past 20 years or 40 years, but really of hundreds of years of Afghan history, is that when one group rules over the entire country sort of ruthlessly, we're in for a recipe for disaster and continued insurgency.
Michael, one of the tools the international community, and I use the term very loosely, international community, is sanctions. Now, we've seen sanctions in the past, in Iraq, in Iran. In Iraq, they seem to actually strengthen Saddam Hussein, but affect the rest of the population and drive them into poverty. Sanctions aren't really a useful tool here. What is a useful tool to put pressure on the Taliban government? Is it sanctions or is it something completely different?
As it happens, I was part of the sanctions regime while the Taliban were in power. I was working on the humanitarian side, trying to monitor the impact on the population and find ways of mitigating it. So, and we do actually have some history of that, of trying to mitigate. But before we talk about actively using the tool of sanctions, the first thing which I'm sure that the international actors will try to use to sort of broker a new relationship with the Taliban is of course assistance. They will start talking about humanitarian assistance. They will hold out the prospect of restoration of larger amounts of development assistance. I think they will go into it. You can expect discussions starting on this really in the coming days. And there will be a hope from the, first of all, from the United Nations that we heard about at the start, but also from countries which have been contributing bilateral assistance. There will be a hope that they can come up with an agreed way of dealing with the Taliban. But I think that these are going to be extremely difficult discussions, because the basic attitude amongst this of the old guard of the movement, who are now in charge in Kabul, is that we've defeated a superpower, we've defeated the world, we showed that we were right. We no longer have to make concessions to anybody, and we will set the terms for anything that happens here. At a point when the internationals are likely to go into such negotiations thinking that they don't have any money, they need us, there will be a catastrophe if we don't actually restore this assistance. We have certain red lines that we need to show to our donors in terms of, for example, women's access to services. I think they're going to find the Taliban are in no mood to compromise, and the donors are going to have to decide, okay, are we going to sign a blank check on humanitarian assistance, or are we going to insist on certain principles? So definitely the tool that the main issue for discussion at the start of international engagement in Kabul will indeed be assistance, and it will first of all be humanitarian assistance, but it will not be easy to get agreement on the continuation of the flows of humanitarian assistance. And we know that from the experience of last time round. Again, I was part of the UN's discussions with the Taliban to try and negotiate protocols the last time round. It was difficult.
Jennifer, you've written extensively on the politics of aid and what that means between different countries and the international community. Here, it seems to me that what Michael is suggesting is that, yes, there will be a negotiation going on, but you've got two parties that have very different negotiating positions. Adding to that, there is a massive amount of donor fatigue when it comes to giving money to the Taliban. There are a number of countries that have already said, look, let's not do this. Let's not go down that path. What's next? Can these negotiations, these discussions for humanitarian aid succeed under that climate?
Absolutely, and they already have. I mean, if we look at, Ubaidullah mentioned Qatar's role, they're already providing aid and assistance. A C-130 came in from Pakistan today. I saw to Kunar province delivering aid. China has already promised $31 million in assistance, including coronavirus vaccines. So aid is already beginning to flow back into the country. Now, is it the same levels that it was under the United States, right? The United States provided 75-80% of the country's budget. That's going to be a huge deficit for the Taliban to begin to try to fill. I don't think any of these countries in the region will be able to fill that gap. But on the other hand, I think what we're going to see is these regional players play a much more important role. As we see the United States, sort of this great power politics sort of recede in the region, politics in Afghanistan will become much more regionalized, probably more fractionalized, and we'll begin to see regional players fill in that gap. Now, it won't be the same way. I think the United Nations is going to have a hard time, but I think, as Michael suggested, they don't have a lot of leverage in all of this right now. They think they do with the money and the resources that they have, but the publics in these countries, especially the United States, for example, understood that the U.S. left in such a disastrous way. If we look at President Biden's public opinion polls here in the United States, he's taken a dramatic hit for the way that he withdrew. Even though there was tremendous public support for withdrawal, there was not support for the way he did this. If we see pictures of famine, that will inevitably occur given the current dynamics in Afghanistan, I think it would be very hard for the American public to resist. Talking about sanctions in such an environment seems horribly cruel when people are going to be suffering so much. So I would agree completely with Michael that I don't think the international community or the United States actually has that much leverage on the humanitarian assistance side. Now, direct government aid is another question. But there are ways that this can be, that there are ways around this. For example, if we look at the healthcare sector in Afghanistan, a lot of attention has been pointed to the fact that clinics are no longer getting assistance.
Sorry, Jennifer, we are running out of time, and I do want to come to the other guests as well. Abdullah, I'll come to you in just a second, but I want to come to Michael first. One of the things that we are talking about direct government aid and international pressure, is getting a partner that can work with the country that you're trying to deal with. In Afghanistan's case, that has traditionally been Pakistan. Is Pakistan a fair partner here, a fair negotiating partner here, Michael?
I think that now that the Taliban are installed in power in Kabul, the Taliban are going to be extremely reluctant to accept any intermediary. They are going to be demanding that any international actors deal directly with them. So, and we saw that even when the director of the Pakistan intelligence service came into Kabul and had a role in brokering the agreement amongst the Taliban for the cabinet, this was extremely controversial, even amongst the Taliban. So I think that you should expect that the Taliban will be demanding that we will talk directly. And if there are, if there are issues with the United Nations, no mediator or broker is going to be able to solve them. It will only be solved directly between the Taliban and the international actors.
Now, Abdullah, are we going to see a smarter Taliban, more smarter than they were in 96, understand that they need to negotiate with the international community, but it's going to be a negotiation, not a demand? Because it seems to me that our guests are saying, actually, until they stop demanding and make an actual negotiation, it's going to be very difficult to come to an agreement.
Look, misplaced arrogance can be horrendous for countries, especially for those who rule the country. The idea is here, the ideological traditionalism that the Taliban enjoy enable them to live in an alternative reality at times where when they're faced with battle assessment issues as to whether they can win a battle or not, they believe that Valkyries and angels would land and support them. When faced with a famine, they believe that God will eventually provide for the people, which means that their own agency and their own sense of responsibility is minimized. And they believe that as long as they have integrity, everything else should be fine. As your other guest said, that they might do better in the integrity department. The idea is the skill set is missing. I'm afraid that Afghanistan just seems to have come out of one corrupt regime into another that has tyrannical tendencies. And it's sad because the world hadn't seen famine and hunger and the sort of crises that we're looking at in Afghanistan in decades. I really don't want our country to be a first example of that in recent history.
Jennifer, just quickly, is aid the answer then? Is starting negotiations at the very beginning around humanitarian aid a good start point? Or is it just actually what we're doing is it's the only thing that we can do? We can't do anything else.
I think right now it is the only thing that we can do, but it is a positive sum outcome. So it allows the government to engage with the international community and allows the people of Afghanistan to receive aid. We know that famine is not a result of natural disaster. Famine is a political failure. And Afghanistan cannot afford another political failure like this.
I want to thank all our guests, Abdullah Bahir, Jennifer Brick, Murtazashvili and Michael Sample. Thank you for watching as well. Now, you can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. We are @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.